For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It's November the 26th. We're in Shmuel Beis. We're up to Perek Yud, chapter 10. The last thing that happened is we had the episode of David HaMelech dealing with this son of Yehonah's son, Mephibosheth, and his slave, Tziva, or the slave of the household of Shaul. Vayhi acharei chen, it was after this, Vayamos melech b'nei Ammon, the king of Ammon died. Vayimloch Chanun b'no tachtov, and his son, Chanun, ruled in his place. Vayomer David said, Eseh chesed im Chanun ben Nachash, I will do kindness with Chanun, the son of Nachash. Nachash was the previous king. Kasha asa aviv yimadi chesed, just like his father did chesed with me. Vayishlach David lenachamo, and David sent to console him, to console Chanun, the Yad Avadav, in the hands of his servants. David sent servants, sent subjects of his, to go and console the new king, Chanun, El Aviv, concerning his father, Nachash, who had just died. Vayavo Avdei David, Eretz Bnei Ammon, and the servants of David came to the land of Bnei Ammon. They came there to console him. Vayomru Sarei Bnei Ammon El Chanun, Adunehem, and the officers, the government officials of Bnei Ammon said to Chanun, their master, HaMechabed David Asavicha Be'inecha, do you think that David is honoring your father in your eyes? Kishalach Lacha Menachamim, because he sent you those who would console you? That's not what David is out to do. Halo Ba'avur Chakores Ha'ir Ularagla Ulhafcha. It's in order to
search,
investigate, right? Search out, seek out the city, and to spy it out and to overturn it. Shalach David esavadav elecha. David sent his servants to you. These are not out to console you. They are actually here on a mission to spy on Ammon so that they can come to the city, the main city of Ammon, and eventually destroy it. Which David had conquered all the nations around Eretz Yisrael. Ammon is a neighboring nation, and so, no question, that's what David is out to do. So, what do you do if you have people coming to your country that you believe are really their spies? Yeah.
Correct.
Well, because that's how they think.
Okay. All right. So we'll see. We'll see whether they're right. Vayikach Chanun es Avdei David. Chanun took the servants of David. Vayigalach es Chatzi Zekanam. He shaved half their beards. So this was a way of embarrassing, shaming them.
Mm-hmm.
If they all have beards, and you shave half the beard, it takes a while for it to grow back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a permanent or a long term sign of shame. Vayichros es madvehem b'chetzi, and they cut off their clothing halfway, ad shisosehem, until essentially their midsections. So they would be naked from the waist down. Vayishalachem, and he sent them. So here he really shamed them and sent them away. Vayagidu David, and they told David, Vayishlach likrosam, as they sent messages to David, and David sent to greet them. Ki hayu ha'anashim nichlamim ma'od, the men were very ashamed. Vayomer HaMelech, the king said, Shivu birecho, settle in Yericho, which was a border city, ad yitzamach zekanchem v'shavtem, until your beards grow back, and then you'll return. So David gave them a place to stay on a border town, not their home cities, not Yerushalayim. Stay there until your beards grow back, and then you'll rejoin everybody in Yerushalayim. David was not pleased with the way his subjects were treated.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Vayiru b'nei Amon ki niv'ashu b'David. So then the b'nei Amon saw that they had now David was upset with them. They saw that now they've worn out their welcome with David. They're in big trouble, which makes you wonder what were they thinking.
Vayishlechu
v'nei Amon. So then the people of Amon sent. They knew that they could not win a war against David. David had already proven himself to be a very powerful warrior, and all the other nations around Eretz Yisrael had been humbled. So what's going to happen now? Vayizkiru es Aram Beis Rechov. So they hired Aram Beis Rechov ves Aram Tzova, and Aram Tzova, these are areas to the northeast of Syria. So you're in the northeastern Syria and also northern Iraq, present day Iraq. Esrim Elef Ragli, 20,000 foot soldiers. Ves Melech Ma'acha Elef Ish. And also they enlisted the help of the king of Ma'acha, or the king Ma'acha, 1,000 men. V'ish Tov, and also another person they enlisted his help, Ish Tov, Shnemasar Elef Ish, who had 12,000 men. The Psukim in Divrei Hayamim, in Chronicles, which has the parallel story to this story here, actually lists even more soldiers that joined this fight. Vayishma David heard that they had now banded together. Vayishlach es Yoav beis kol hatzava hagiborim, so he sent Yoav, his general, and all of the army, the strong ones, to go and fight them. Vayetzu b'nei Amon, so the b'nei Amon came out. Vayarchu milchama pesach hashar, and they arranged the battle in front of the gate of their main city. Va'aram tzova u'rechov v'ishtov u'ma'acha, and then their allies, Aram tzova, Rechov, Ishtov, and Ma'acha, levadam basadeh, they were alone in the field. So they weren't in the cities. They were. Let's read through the parak first. So they were another group, another army group in the field. So they essentially outflanked Yoav. So Yoav now has the B'nai Amon on one side of him, and he has these allies, Aram Tzova, Rechov, Ishtov, and Ma'acha, on the other side of him. Vayah Yoav ki haisa ilav p'nei ha-milchama, and Yoav saw that he had against him the face of the war, mipanim u'me'achar, from the front and from the back. Vayivchar mikol b'churei v'Yisrael, and he chose from all of the young men of Yisrael, Vayarach liklas Aram, and he arranged to fight Aram. So he chose the best warriors as the main group that will fight with the ones in the field who will fight with Aram, which apparently was the stronger fighting force. Veis Yeseram, the rest of the nation, meaning the rest of the army, Nasam Biyad Avshai Achiv, he put them in the hands of Avshai, or as we'll see, his name is really Avishai, he's sometimes called Avshai, his brother, Vayarach liklas B'nei Amon, and he arranged himself to go fight with B'nei Amon. So essentially they split the army in two. One would face one direction and fight Aram. That would be Aram was the stronger fighting force, so that was Yoav's task to fight with Aram, and he took the best soldiers to do that. And the rest of the soldiers were with his brother Avshai to fight with B'nei Amon. Vayomer. So Yoav gave instructions to his brother. He said, Im techezak Aram imeni, if Aram is stronger than me, if they start beating me, v'ayisa li Yeshua, you will be for me as a salvation. You'll come and help me out. V'im b'nei Amon yechezku mimcha, if the b'nei Amon, they become stronger than you, they're beating you, v'alachti lo shi'alach, I will go to save you. So as long as one of us is successful, then we'll help the other one. Obviously, if they're both unsuccessful, we're in big trouble. But they had supply lines and they had messengers, and and it wasn't that far apart. Chazak v'nis chazek b'ad amenu, be strong and strengthen yourselves for our nation, uv'ad arei elokeinu, and for the cities of Hashem, because they knew that if they got beaten, then what would happen next? Then this force would go attack the Jewish cities. And Hashem will do the good in his eyes. So from this statement over here, Yoav's final words to Avishai, does Yoav sound like he is confident of victory?
Yes.
No.
Okay, so it sounds like he's a little bit unsure. He says we got to be strong. We got to fight for our nation and for our cities. And Hashem will do what he sees as good. We got to rely on Hashem over here because we're really not in a very good position over here. We're outflanked and we've got a very powerful force that we are fighting with. And so Yoav says, look, we've got to do our ishtadlus. So we'll do what we can do. We'll put in our effort, and Hashem will do what is good. Whatever what good could mean winning or losing, whatever Hashem wants. Yoav then approached with his nation for war against Aram. Vayanusu mipanav, and Aram fled from before him. Yoav smacked Aram. He really attacked and beat them badly. Now, that was the first attack. Yoav attacked before Avishai attacked the Bnei Amon. Uvnei Amon ro ki nas Aram. The Bnei Amon saw that Aram was in retreat. Vayanus mipanav Avishai. So they also fled before Avishai. Vayavohu ha'ir, they barricaded themselves in the city. They ran into the city and closed the gate, and that's where they barricaded themselves. Now, that's important to know for later, that the Bnei Amon are now holed up inside of their main city. Their army is holed up inside their main city. Vayashav Yoav me'al Bnei Amon vayavohu Yerushalayim. So then Yoav returned from the Bnei Amon and came to Yerushalayim. So they did not at this time lay siege to the city of Amon, although they will later, but right now they have defeated Aram very badly, and the Bnei Amon are now holed up inside their city, afraid of the Jewish army. Now Aram saw that they had been struck down in front of Bnei Yisrael. Yachadei were not willing to accept defeat, and they gathered together. Vayishlach Hadar Ezer, and Hadar Ezer sent. Now Hadar Ezer we had before. Back in Perek Ches, in chapter 8, when David was beating all the nations around him, Hadar Ezer got beaten pretty badly there. Hadar Ezer has already been beaten once before, attempting to fight with David. And David beat him badly, and took a lot of his wealth. So here, Hadar Ezer is not through yet. He's looking for revenge and he's looking to save face. So Hadar Ezer sent Vayotze es Aram Asher Me'ever Hanar. And now he took Aram that was on the other side of the river, Vayavo Chelam, and they came to Chelam. Now, the other side of the river, usually when we know that Ever Hayarden, the other side of the Yarden, means the eastern bank of the Yarden. Here it would mean the Euphrates River, which would be. So now we're getting further and further north and east of where Aram is. Think about present day Syria. As you move further and further east and further north, you cross the Euphrates, perhaps the Tigris and Euphrates rivers over there.
West.
You're going further east and further north in order as you get more further away from Eretz Yisrael. So he brought people from the other side of the river. Vayavo Chelam, they came to Chelam. Vishovach Sar Tzva Hadar Ezer Lifnehem. And now a new figure, Shovach, the general of Hadar Ezer, was before them. Now Shovach was a very powerful warrior. When the Mishnah in Maseches Sota is describing the difference between us going to war and the non-Jews going to war. So the Mishnah contrasts how the non-Jews put their faith in their warrior and we put our faith in Hashem. So the Mishnah says, the Plishtim put their faith in Goliath. We put our faith in Hashem. What happened to the Plishtim? Goliath was killed and they were routed from the battlefield. The Aram, the Mishnah continues, put their faith in Shovach, and what's going to happen is the same thing. Shovach is going to be killed and they're going to be routed. But just showing you, Shovach is considered to be a very powerful warrior, maybe not as large as Goliath, perhaps not as big as Goliath, but clearly from the way the Mishnah presents it, the Aram, the nation of Aram, and the warriors of Aram looked at Shovach as being a game changer, as being somebody that if he's on the battlefield, it's impossible to lose. just like the Plishtim looked at it when they had Goliath on the battlefield. We described it back then, that when you're dealing with hand-to-hand combat, then if you have this massive warrior that you would have to throw at him dozens and dozens of soldiers, he changes the whole battlefield. Mm-hmm. So Shovach was the same way. Vayugad Lidavta, the actually, and in Divrei Hayamim, Shovach is spelled Shofach with a fey instead of a vase. We have it as Shovach, Shin Vav Vase Chaf. In Divrei Hayamim it says Shofach, which means to spill over. Mm-hmm. And the Gemara says because when opposing soldiers would see him, they would be unable to maintain themselves.
Oh.
And they would spill over. That would be that's what it's shofach. So it's out of fear. Vayugad David, this was told to David. Vayesof es kol Yisrael, he gathered all the Jewish people. So now he's not sending Yoav in his stead. He's going to fight this battle. Vayavor es hayarden, he crossed the Yarden. Vayavol chelama, he came to chelam. Vayachu Aram niklas David. Aram arranged themselves to face David. Vayilacham uimo, they fought with him. Vayonas Aram mipnei Yisrael. Aram fled before the Jewish people. Vayaharok David me Aram. David killed from Aram shva meos rechev, 700 chariots. Ve'arboim elef parashim, and 40,000 horsemen. Ve'es shovach sar tzevo hika vayamas sham. And Shovach, the general of Aram, David struck down and he was killed there. Again, in Divrei Hayamim, it expands the numbers over here that in addition to the 7,000 chariots and the cavalry, there were also many, many thousands upon thousands of infantry, foot soldiers, that David killed as well in this battle. Vayiru, it doesn't necessarily mean David did it single-handedly, but it means that in this battle, it seems that he's the one who killed Shovach, just from the way it's being presented. It also seems that the reason why David went to war himself, even though Yoav was, as we've mentioned before, was a very powerful warrior in his own right, but it seems that once Shovach was being sent into battle, then David was the one to fight him. Vayiru kol ha-melachim avdei Hadarezer, and now all of the kings, the slaves, the servants of Hadarezer saw ki nigfu lifnei Yisrael, that they were struck down before the Bnei Yisrael. Vayashlimu es Yisrael, so they made peace with Yisrael. Vayavdum, and they served the Jewish people. They decided to become
vassals.
Thank you to the Jewish people. Vayiru Aram lohoshia od es Bnei Amon. Aram was no longer; they were now afraid to come to the aid of Bnei Amon anymore. Aram was now humbled. They were no longer going to go and help Amon. And therefore, the next stage of the battle is going to be to lay siege to the city of Amon to humble Bnei Amon. And they're not going to have any problem anymore of Aram coming to their aid. Aram is finished. So that's going to be the last part of this battle of David completely subduing the nations around Eretz Yisrael. But the next story in the Navi is the famous story, although very misunderstood story, of David and Bathsheba. Mm-hmm. And therefore the siege against Ammon is going to be mixed in with the story of David and Bathsheba. As we will see, it's going to play a role in as we move through the story of David and Bathsheba. But that is not for this week. That is, we'll start that, please God, next week. The first question we have to deal with over here is what is there's two major questions to deal with. I will present the questions and then we will present a possible approach over here. The one major question is, what are the causes and effects over here? There's a lot being left out of the story. What was the cause of David sending these people? He says, I want to do chesed, and I'll send the people to be Menachem Avil, to console him. Okay, he's a nice guy. So why were they so suspicious? And then they antagonize David, which is a crazy thing to do. He's the most powerful army, the most powerful fighting force, perhaps in the world, but certainly in that area. And what are you doing? It seems so foolish. So how do we understand the causes and effects of what's going on over here? The other thing is that in the last chapter, in Perek Tes, chapter 9, we have a very interesting parallel with the story of Mephibosheth and Siva. If you look back in the beginning of chapter 9, it says in Pasuk Aleph, verse 1, Vayomer David, David said, Hachi Ashod Asher Nosa Levei Shaul, is anybody left from the house of Shaul? Ve'esa imo chesed. I'll do chesed with him, Bavur Yehonah's son, for Yehonah's son. So I'll do kindness with him. So we have two chapters in a row where David initiates something because he wants to do chesed, undo kindness. One is with the previous ruling family, Shaul's family, because of Yehonah's son. And then again, here, and now it's for a foreign nation, not even Jews, he wants to do this, he wants to do chesed to the king of Ammon. So why is David interested in doing chesed? So that has to be dealt with as well.
Once you're saying that you're doing chesed, isn't it lots of chesed if you're announcing, I'm doing chesed,
what I do. He's not announcing it. I mean, I don't know who's announcing it to. It just sounds like we're inside David's head. He's saying that he's going to do these things. But at any rate...
Don't you just do chesed? You don't say, I'm going
to do chesed. It seems like he was looking for it. He was in Perek Tes, he said, I want to find someone with whom I can do chesed. In Perek Yud, he's deciding to do it. I mean, you know, he's telling us what his motivation is.
You think he's trying to rack up some mitzvahs because he knows he wants to do something?
Okay. So let's look in Perek Yud right now, chapter 10, and let's deal with the causes and effects, and then we'll deal with the chesed part of it. There is a pasuk in the Torah. The Torah says regarding Moab and Ammon, we know, of course, we've already dealt with extensively that Lo Yavo Moavi Ammoni Moavi Bikal Hashem, that anybody from Ammon and Moab cannot marry into the Jewish people, but we know that only applies to the men, not to the women. We discussed this extensively with Rus, and it affected David with Goliath, the whole discussion whether David was a valid Jew or not. But we know that they are prohibited, at least the men are prohibited, from marrying to the Jewish people. And the reason is because Ammon and Moab, they, number one, did not greet us when we left Egypt. Mm-hmm. They did not greet us with bread and water. And they should have, as a sense of gratitude to us because our great-great-great-grandfather helped their great-great-grandfather. They would not have existed if it wasn't for our great-great-grandfather, Avraham Avinu, which is the only reason why Lot was saved from Sodom, and the only reason why Ammon and Moab, who come from Lot, exist, is because of Avraham Avinu. And they decided to ignore that, and therefore they are punished. In addition, they added insult to injury by hiring Bilam to curse the Jewish people, and in the end, Bilam caused us to do terrible averos, and it was through the Benos Moav, through the daughters of Moav, that we were brought to terrible sins. So there is this pasuk. Now the pasuk then ends off saying, "Lo sidrosh shlomam v'tovasam koyam echal le'olam." Do not seek out their goodness and their peace all your days forever. Do not try to do good with Ammon and Moab. Do not try to seek peace with Ammon and Moab. We are not meant to be nice and friendly with Moab and Ammon. Perhaps we don't have to wipe them out the way we have to wipe out Amalek, but there is no place for the Jewish nation to have a nice, wonderful relationship with Moab and Ammon. That's not what we're meant to do. That is what the pasuk says. So if that's so, why is David doing chesed with the king of Ammon? And the answer is, the Gemara tells us, because we learned before that when David was on the run from Shaul, he was afraid that his family would be attacked, mm-hmm. His father, his mother, his brothers, and he asked the king of Moab to take them in. because since David ultimately comes from Moab, from Rus, and so does his father, so do his brothers, so therefore he wants them cared for, and he thought that the only foreign nation that he could count on would be Moab, because at least there is some familial relationship. The king of Moab took them in, but after David left, he murdered all of David's family. One brother escaped, and he ran. Excuse me?
He was a cripple.
No, that was then Yehonah's son's family. One brother escaped, and he ran to Ammon. And the king of Ammon took in David's brother and saved David's brother from the king of Moab. So here David wants to reciprocate, says he took care of my brother, so I want to help out. I want to console the new king of Ammon. Why were the government officials of the king of Ammon, why were they suspicious of David? They said to their king, you think that David HaMelech, you think King David, is simply sending people to console you? It says in their Torah that the Jewish people are not allowed to be friendly with the people of Ammon. It says in their Torah that they're not supposed to seek out our goodness and our peace. If he's sending people to us, you can be sure it is not just to console us. You can be sure that they're being sent here for an insidious reason, and that would be to spy on us and to be able to attack us. So they were aware of the Pasuk. The Pasuk in Eich actually says that B'nai Ammon and Moab are fully aware of the fact that they're prohibited from joining us. That's why when the Beis HaMikdash, when the Babylonians attacked and defeated us, the people from Ammon and Moab came in and they burned the Sifrei Torah. The reason they burned the Sifrei Torah is because it says in the Sifrei Torah they're not allowed to join the Jewish people. And they resent that, and therefore they burn the Sifrei Torah. So they're aware of the fact that they are excluded from the Jewish people, and therefore they were not willing to believe that David had altruistic reasons for sending his servants to them. And that's why they told their king that they're here to spy on the land. The king reacts by taking these people and making a statement. And the statement is one which is a very disrespectful statement. It is meant to send a message to David. What message are they sending David? Now, put yourself in their shoes, put your head in their heads. Like, David is sending these people to spy on us, and he's trying to trick us. He's doing it with a ruse. He's saying that they're here to console me, the king, and they're really here to spy on me. I'm going to show him. So what's the message the king of Ammon is sending David?
You must think I'm stupid, but I'm not. I know who you're sending.
Okay,
at
good.
At the time, you're half covering your actions. You're like...
Okay, you're using the half part of it. Okay, okay.
You don't have anything to do with us, so we're going to show you.
Okay. I can see through this business.
We're going to embarrass
you. Okay, we're going to embarrass you. I have no respect for you. You're trying to, you know, what kind of a disgusting thing is this to send someone on the pretext of consolation, and in fact, you're really spies. What a low down thing to do. Well, that's not respectful at all. You have no respect in my eyes, and this is the way I'm going to treat your people. He sends them back in this way. Now, what about the fact that David is this powerful warrior with this powerful army? What are you doing? You may have exposed his plan, but aren't you afraid of what's going to happen? Evidently, they weren't afraid. He felt confident he could send this message back to David and they would be okay. Why did he have the confidence to do that? Well, you think about it. If David is in fact as powerful as it would seem, why does he need a pretext? Why does he need to spy out Ammon? Just send an army and attack us. Why does he go? Why is he lowering himself to this tactic of tricking me into thinking he's coming to console me, but really he's spying out the land? Apparently he's weaker than we thought. Apparently he doesn't have the ability to attack us. We really are frightening to him. And therefore, that gave a lot of confidence, a lot of of bravado to the king of Ammon that he doesn't have to take this from David. We're actually peers. We're equals. I'm not afraid of him. And so he does this. But what happens is that when he sends them back and it becomes clear, even though the Pesukim don't tell us how it becomes clear, but it becomes clear that, in fact, David was sincere. He really was sending consolation. He wasn't coming to spy on them. Well, once you realize that, now you're in really big trouble, because he wasn't doing anything that was tricky. He really was completely above board. You went and you shamed his people. You went and accused David of being tricky when he really wasn't. And you made the fatal mistake of believing that David was weak. And that's why he was doing all of this. But in fact, David wasn't weak. If he wanted to attack, he would have attacked. Now we're in big trouble, because David can turn around and attack. So now Ammon is really stuck. They've built this whole paradigm out of what they thought was going on when it really wasn't. They made a mistake based on the pasuk of the Torah that says, don't seek out their goodness. Therefore, David must be tricking us. Therefore, David must be weak. But it turns out, David wasn't tricking us, and he's not weak. Now we're in big trouble.
I would argue that it's not Ammon's mistake. They drew an obvious conclusion, just as you've explained it. It was David's mistake.
Okay. So that's the next step. What's wrong with their logic? Why did David do it? Okay. Yeah.
So they're reading our Bible, and they're not reading the part that says those who are good to you will be blessed, and those who aren't good to you won't be blessed. They seem to select.
I don't know if they're reading the Chumash. They knew about this. I don't know if they were told it, if it was well known. They knew about this. But it doesn't matter, because here the Torah says, don't seek out their goodness. The real question over here is, fine, this all makes sense, but you got to go back to the beginning. What was David doing? Why aren't the advisors of Ammon right that David couldn't possibly be sending sincere consolation, because you're not allowed to seek out their good?
But I just see the king of Ammon, because he's just lost his father, and he thinks that he's trying to mourn his father properly, whatever way that is for him, and then he thinks that somebody's coming and undermining him. I could see him reacting very emotionally.
Okay.
That makes sense.
The Medrash says over here that Hashem says to David, it doesn't mean he actually said it, but this is the message that Hashem was sending David. You think you don't have to pay attention to what it says in the Torah? Don't seek out the shalom and the tov of Ammon? You think you can ignore that pasuk?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to make it clear that you can't ignore that pasuk.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to bring a large army against you, and you're going to have to fight them. Meaning, the start of the problem over here is David makes a mistake. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a subtle mistake, because we can understand that, what do you mean? The king of Ammon did help David. He saved his brother. So there is something over there that David does feel a sense of gratitude, a sense of reciprocation over here. But nevertheless, on David's level, he is making a mistake that he should not be ignoring the pasuk that says you're not allowed to seek out their good and their shalom. You can't do that. So David acts sincerely. Hashem says, you're not allowed to do that. Therefore, Hashem allows the people of Ammon to interpret David's actions based on what his actions should have been. His actions should have been not to send consolation, because you're not allowed to seek out their good. And therefore, they are operating based on what David should have done, which is a mistake, because that's not what David did, but it's what David should have done. And therefore, they build a whole story, and it turns into a very large battle. Hashem wants there to be a big battle over here, which probably explains why, even though we don't see that David got angry, but they figured David is angry, and they amass a massive army to defend and attack David. And David is now forced to go to battle, and you notice that in this perek, unlike in perek Ches, where we had the battles before, David was just wiping them out. One after the other, one after the other, one after the other. There was no problem. It was like no defense against David's army. Here, all of a sudden, we have a battle in which, first of all, there's fear on the Jewish side. And second of all, there's strategy against the Jews where they get surrounded. And Yoav has to say to Avishai, well, okay, listen, we don't know what Hashem wants over here. Perhaps Hashem has decided that we're going to lose this battle and a lot of us are going to get killed. We don't know. It's up to Hashem, but we have to do our effort. We have to do Ishtadlus. We're going to split up. I'll go this way, you go that way. We'll attack and we'll try to help each other out. And Hashem will do whatever is good. Now, Baruch Hashem, Hashem wasn't interested in the people getting killed and losing the battle. But he was interested in a battle happening that was a little bit scary, a little precarious, one that would give pause to the army, to David, to rethink, maybe this battle should never have happened. This was one that was brought against us. It wasn't one that we were meant to do, like in the other battles where I needed to subdue everybody around us. This one was brought against us. And in fact, a powerful, powerful warrior in Shovach comes to join the battle, forcing David himself to go to battle, not even sending Yoav the second time, but coming out himself. The Jews win a massive victory in the end. But still, the message from Hashem to David is very clear, that you ignored a pasuk in the Torah, and therefore I'm going to make sure you remember the pasuk. You're not going to be able to ignore it. Even the slightest transgression on your part is going to be met with a very clear message from me that you've got to make sure not to ignore any of the Torah.
But he didn't go to seek out kindness from them. He went to give kindness.
That's
to
true.
Them.
That's true. What it says is, lo tidrosh shlomam. Drosha means to, like, I don't think the Torah means don't elicit kindness from them.
That's
don't try to have a relationship of shalom and tov with them. There should be a relationship perhaps. What's that?
Arms neutrality.
Yeah, I was going to say tolerance. You know, that's about right. You know, like
cold peace.
Right, a resentful tolerance. Yeah.
So, what is he saying to us? You know, let's say about the whole Gentile nation. Let's say during the Holocaust, there were Gentiles that did.
Can't go there. I can't go there. We're still here with Amon. We're going to deal with this.
So
I'm not done yet. You're going to have to wait. I'm not done yet dealing with this. We're still moving on with this. But we can't move this into other areas. We have to stick here.
No,
we've got to stick with Amon only. Only Amon.
Okay, so Amon.
Amon. We're not supposed to like Amon.
Of course.
Right.
You know, what's the difference between diplomacy? You send messengers to.
This wasn't diplomacy. David was sending sincere chesed. It wasn't diplomacy. He said, I want to do chesed.
So
Hashem says, you're wrong. Hashem's saying to him, you're wrong. You can't do chesed with them.
So someone that says, does chesed to you, you should...
Not someone, Amon.
Amon. So does chesed to you, you should ignore.
Apparently. Apparently. Yeah.
It reminds me of like Avraham, because he was all about chesed, and then Hashem said, let's test. I'm going to give you something that isn't chesed to see if you can do it or not.
Okay.
So maybe he's testing David by saying,
okay, that
you
could
want
be.
To do chesed.
That could be.
Let's see if you understand the limits.
It could be. Now, it could be because this was on a national level. This was the head of state. This wasn't doing chesed to an individual Amon person. This was the head of the Jewish people doing chesed with the head of the Amon people. And that might have been, that might be what's really wrong to do. So that could be. We just have to move on because we're going to run out of time. So quick.
I was just going to say, we haven't had Jewish kings much before.
Yeah, right, that's
Shaul,
true.
And he had some bad judgments, so we didn't have precedent between us and international
That's true.
Relations.
That's true. The foreign policy still has to be developed. That's true. Now, this wasn't a terrible sin. It wasn't like David did a huge thing wrong over here, but it was the wrong way to govern the country, and Hashem is sending him the message. Okay, fine. We're still dealing with David. Remember, we're dealing with one of the greatest people to ever walk the face of the earth. We're not dealing with someone doing a terrible thing over here, but the fact of the matter is that he was given a message that it was wrong. Now, what is motivating David to look for ways to do chesed? In the last chapter, he looks to do chesed with Shaul's family. Here, he looks to do chesed with the king of Ammon, and in so doing, he makes a mistake, and he overlooks what it says in the Torah. So what is motivating David? Now, this next point, it's a subtle point, but it's a critical subtle point, and it will inform the entire story of David and Bathsheba. Therefore, it's very, very important that you hear the subtle point. So I'm asking you to listen carefully and try to accept rather than argue with it. We're not looking here for alternative methods of understanding it. We're looking here to accept the subtlety of this point. But it's critical because the story of David and Bathsheba is so misunderstood, and without this piece, the whole thing is really impossible to understand. David wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash, we know that. And he was about to do it, and he came to Nathan, he said, I'm going to do it. And Hashem told him, go stop him. He said, go do it. First he said, go do it. And then Hashem told the Navi, go stop him right now, because David's going to start doing it. The next morning, it's too late. Yeah. So David tells Nathan, I want to build it. Nathan says, go ahead. That night Hashem says to Nathan, go tell David to stop. He can't do it. So David is told he can't do it. So David, though we know that he was given the guarantee that it's going to be his family that's going to rule forever, and the Jews are going to go on forever, David has great gratitude to Hashem, and Hashem says, your son will build the Beis HaMikdash. Okay. Which son? Which son? Now we know it's going to be Shlomo, King Solomon. We know that. There is no Shlomo yet. He's not born yet. So which son? David has some sons, some very, very distinguished sons, actually. One of whom, Abigail's son, is one of the ones who will live his life and never do a sin his entire life. So we're dealing with some pretty special people. But Shlomo HaMelech is not yet born. Okay.
What was Abigail's son?
His name was, he had two names, either Daniel or Kilav. Two names. Now, David then embarks on subduing and defeating all the nations around him, because he understands that if I can't build the Beis HaMikdash, it's my job to enable the building of the Beis HaMikdash. To build the Beis HaMikdash, we need peace and we need wealth. So David goes around, he attacks and defeats all the nations around him, subduing all of them and forcing them to pay tribute and enriching, not himself, but enriching the coffers of what would eventually be the Beis HaMikdash. So that's what David does. So David sets the stage for his son. That makes sense, right? If you can't build the Beis HaMikdash, then what you do is you prepare the ground for the Beis HaMikdash. Eventually, one of the last acts David is going to do is actually purchase the land of the Beis HaMikdash. He's going to do that before he dies. From Arav Nahayavusi. It's going to be at the very end of Shmuel Beis. We'll see. He's going to purchase the land. So he's setting the stage. Great. Now, if you're going to build the Beis HaMikdash, if your son is going to build the Beis HaMikdash, in addition to defeating the nations around you, getting all the wealth, buying the land, but you also have to produce the son, right? Whoever's going to build, you got to produce him. For whatever reason, David knew that this son who's going to build the Beis HaMikdash has not yet been born, even though he had distinguished children, but they were not the ones. Not only that, but David knew, and he was correct, that he wasn't yet married to the woman who would be the mother of the son who would build the Beis HaMikdash. David knew this. David knew that as great as his wives were, I mean, he was married to unbelievable women. Michal, daughter of Shaul, Abigail, and he was married to wonderful women. Great tzidkanios. Wonderful people. Nevertheless, he understood none of them would be the mother of Malchus, of royalty. Now, that is a difficult thing for us to understand. The main reason why it's difficult for us to understand is because we're used to only one wife. We're not used to the whole idea of having more than one wife. A king having several wives means that David understood that each wife has a different strength. Each wife has a different thing that she brings to the royal family, and none of them had the quality necessary to produce the next king. Who is that woman? That woman is Bathsheba. The Gemara tells us, you'll hear me repeat this several times as we go through the story of David and Bathsheba, that Bathsheba was designated for David HaMelech from Sheshes Yimei Breishis. From the 6 days of creation, Bathsheba was designated for David. David knew, he may not have known that it was Bathsheba, but he knew there was a woman who was designated for him, not for him, for his own personal whatever, you know, his own, right? But rather for him to produce essentially Mashiach, because it all comes from David and Bathsheba, comes Mashiach. David knew this, and he knew that he wasn't married to her yet. Now, there is a fascinating theme that we find when it comes to the significant marriages that produce the line of David HaMelech. Normally, the rules of tznius, of modesty, dictate that it is the man who seeks out the woman. The natural modesty, the natural tznius of a woman is such that it is appropriate for a man to be seeking out a woman. This is true in a broader sense. The Gemara says the man should go to find the woman rather than the woman go to find the man. And this is true also in a much more private sense in matters of intimacy, that it should be the man who is the one who is the initiator. This is true generally speaking. Now, it's not that there is a sin or an avera of some sort if it's done differently, but that's the way that the world is meant to work. And the nature of a man, the nature of a woman works that way. That's natural, that men are more aggressive, more forward, that kind of thing. That's normal. That's we would expect that kind of behavior. Men, women are generally more subdued and more sanua, more on the modest side. With the line of David HaMelech, we find time after time after time where it is the woman who initiates. Who initiated with Lot? Was it Lot who initiated with his daughters, or his daughters who initiated? It was his daughters. Who initiated with Yehuda and Tamar? It was Tamar. Who initiated with Boaz and Ruth? Naomi, a woman, sends Ruth, a woman, to initiate with Boaz. You always find with the line of David that it is the woman who is the initiator, which is not the way, it's not what we would call, I use this term, it's not the way of the world. When I say derech eretz in this term, I don't mean like in terms of appropriate, inappropriate. I mean, it's not the way of the world. It's not the regular way. But that's what you find. This observation was made, that I heard it first from my Rosh Hashiva of Weinberg, Zichron Racha. He made this observation in a class I was in.
You can also add Yishai and his wife.
Okay, but that's a medrash. That's a medrash. Right, Yishai and his wife. That's true. That medrash of Yishai and his wife, you find the same thing. David also understood this. And therefore, David, after he subdued all the nations around him, now what? What's next? The next thing is, I have to marry this woman who's going to produce the Mashiach. How do I find this woman? You can't find this woman. She has to come to you. David understands that although normally the man should seek out the woman, and every instinct in him is saying, go find her, but David also understands, I can't. Because to produce the Mashiach, my line, it's the other way around. She has to find me. So David finishes defeating the enemies around him. Now what? What's he going to do? So he's got to do something.
Wait for the phone to ring.
So David says, right, there's his phone ring. So David says, Hashem is going to make it happen. He's going to bring her to me. But it's not happening. If it's not happening, it must be that somehow I'm still lacking something. Something isn't complete yet. There's more that has to be done to prepare for Hashem to present her to me. But I've got to do something. So we talked last time how David HaMelech needed a Rebbe. He needed to have a Rebbe. And Mephibosheth was that Rebbe. David noticed that lack. But even more so, David noticed something else. And that is the following. The most important midah, the most important characteristic of the king has to be a lot of things. The king has to be a leader. The king has to be humble. It's critical he be humble. The king has to be God-fearing. Lots of things the king has to be. The most critical thing the king has to be is he has to be a Baal Chesed. He has to be one who is into kindness. Because ultimately, the king is in charge of the physical well-being of the people. Where the leader of Torah is in charge of the spiritual well-being of the people, and the Kohen Gadol is in charge of we'll call it the sanctified well-being of the people through the Beis HaMikdash. The king is primarily in charge of the physical well-being, protected from their enemies, that everybody has what to eat, everybody has a place to live, things of that nature, that they're taken care of physically. And that requires chesed. This is why when we learned Megillas Rus, this is why we emphasize that the entire Megillah, Rus and Boaz, is all about chesed. Rus does unbelievable chesed with Naomi and then with Boaz. Boaz does unbelievable chesed with Rus. And that is because to produce David HaMelech, there needed to be the most selfless chesed you could possibly have. And they demonstrate it. David, in this situation, recognizing that Hashem has not yet brought this woman, who's going to be Bathsheba, to him, he realizes, I must not be doing enough chesed. I must do more chesed. So he's looking for opportunities. So first he says, how can I do chesed with Shaul's family? That family that hunted me down, that was out to get me, and I ran away. I want to do chesed. Because the king can't hold a grudge. The king can't be that way. The king has to care for all of his subjects, unless he's going to put someone to death because they're rebellious, which happens, unfortunately. But the king has to take care of everybody. And I got to put my personal issues aside. And then he makes a mistake, but it's the same motivation with Amon. He says, well, I need to do chesed. Well, the Torah says, don't seek out their kindness. Don't seek out their good. Don't seek out their shalom. But I have to do chesed. Perhaps the chesed should even override what it says in the Torah about not seeking out their good, not seeking out their peace. And I should do chesed with them as well. That was a mistake. But the motivation is, I have to find significant opportunities for chesed. One last point, and then we will continue with this theme next week, Blei Neder, and that is that the reason the Rosh Yeshiva gave that when it comes to Malchus, to royalty, the woman has to be the initiator is because the main midah characteristic of women is chesed. Since the main job of women, of Jewish women, is to be enablers, that's the main job. With men and women, the way the Torah sets it up is the men are the doers and the women are the enablers. They share Gan Eden together on equal footing, but the different jobs are divided up as men as the doers and women as enablers. An enabler has to be a person of chesed. You can't be an enabler if you're not someone with chesed. Because enabling, by definition, means I am giving the opportunity to somebody else. I'm not the one seizing the opportunity. I'm giving the opportunity to another person. What's the greatest chesed anybody ever did on the face of the earth? Rachel Imenu. Mm-hmm. This week's parsha. Rachel Imenu, the greatest chesed anybody ever did. The whole reason why we still exist today is because of the unbelievable chesed of Rachel Imenu. What did she do? Mm-hmm. She enabled somebody else. She didn't take it for herself. She enabled somebody else. That can only be done with someone who is all about chesed. Therefore, since the primary midah of women is chesed, when it comes to malchus, to royalty, even though ironically a woman can't be king, it has to be a man who's king, but the midah has to be a chesed midah. Therefore, the initiation of the line of David has to come from the women. It has to be from them. that the line is created and sustained. And therefore, David, recognizing that that woman has not yet stepped forward, it must be that I'm still deficient and lacking in chesed. And therefore, David is seeking opportunities. That's why in Perek Tes and in Perek Yod, David is looking for chesed opportunities. This sets the stage now for that story of David and Bathsheba, which will begin Mitzvah Hashem next week in Perek Yod Aleph. But this is, you have to bear this in mind, we'll have to repeat it next week, where David's mindset is when he is presented with Bathsheba. And then we'll continue next week.
Can I see, do you read the pasuk in Hebrew again?
Lo sidrosh shlomam v'tovasam. Lo sidrosh shlomam v'tovasam. Kol yamecha le'olam.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.